Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, September 2, 2015. President Salva Kiir appoints four top SPLA officials to be part of the Permanent Ceasefire and Transitional Security Arrangement Committee.
They will travel to Addis Ababa and attend a workshop in Addis Ababa on the 4th of this month. Definitely after those workshops, there will be a formation of the joint command that will be stationed here in Juba to oversee the implementation of issues related to the ceasefire.
And Western Bahr al-Ghazal state community gets serious about the importance of education.
We've seen PTAs building parts of schools. This is free work that they do themselves. They're providing the materials, the labour. They're also going around to different villages to promote education and to encourage other parents to send their kids to school.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir briefed senior army officers last night about the peace agreement he signed a week ago. Mr. Kiir outlined to the SPLA commanders how the South Sudan government intends to implement the ceasefire that took effect last week. The president also selected four army officers to attend a workshop in Addis Ababa on transitional security arrangements in South Sudan and on making the ceasefire work. Philip Thonaleu reports for VOA from Juba.
South Sudan Army spokesman Colonel Philip Aguirre says all of the country's top military officers attended the meeting, which was chaired by Mr. Kiir, who is Commander-in-Chief of South Sudan Armed Forces.
The briefing is about the peace agreement and the implementation, particularly the issues of the ceasefire.
Aguirre says military officials agreed at the meeting to implement provisions in the peace deal on security arrangements. The agreement, which was brokered by regional bloc IGAD after months of negotiations, calls for a workshop to be held in Addis Ababa within 14 days of all parties signing the deal. Aguirre says four SPLA officers were nominated during last night's meeting to attend the workshop.
They will travel to Addis Ababa and attend a workshop in Addis Ababa on the 4th of this month. Definitely after those workshops, there will be a formation of the joint command that will be stationed here in Juba to oversee the implementation of issues related to the ceasefire.
At the workshop in Addis Ababa, the military officers will meet their counterparts from Riek Machar's SPLM in opposition and IGAD mediators and discuss, among other things, the drawdown of forces in South Sudan, the creation of demilitarized areas, and the cantonment of troops who fought in the 20-month conflict. The officers who attend the workshop will subsequently help to monitor the ceasefire and security arrangements during a 30-month transitional period in South Sudan. One provision of the security arrangements is that all military forces that are currently in Juba will be redeployed to at least 25 kilometers outside the center of the capital. The redeployment was at the top of a list of reservations that the government raised when Mr. Kiir signed the IGAD brokered peace deal. The government said it objected to the redeployment of the SPLA forces because it undermined South Sudanese sovereignty and because it could cause instability in the military. But Aguirre says the SPLA leaders are optimistic that the peace agreement will be fully implemented.
We hope everything will go well. The army will implement the orders of the commander-in-chief and implement the peace agreement, particularly the ceasefire.
The IGAD peace deal was signed by Machar and former detainee Pagana Amom on August 17 in Addis Ababa. President Kiir signed it 9 days later in Juba. Under the terms of the agreement, Mr. Kiir will continue as commander-in-chief of the SPLA and Machar will remain at the top of the armed opposition for at least 18 months. Juba and three state capitals, Bor, Malakal, and Bentiu, will be demilitarized during the transitional period, and a joint police force, including UN and IGAD forces, will be in charge of security in those towns. For VOA News, I am Philip Thonaleu in Juba.
The U.S. is calling on both parties to adhere to South Sudan's permanent ceasefire and to further develop security arrangements at the security workshop that opens on Saturday. In a statement released today, the U.S. also condemned recent fighting in Jonglei and Upper Nile states and called on all parties to immediately stop any sort of hostile engagement. In the statement, U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Turner says that declarations ordering all forces to cease military operations is seen as a welcome step toward implementing the peace deal, but says recent fighting by forces on both sides, quote, runs contrary to those orders, end quote. Turner reiterates that any action by either side that spoils the peace deal's implementation will face consequences, including UN sanctions. The capital of Western Bahr al-Ghazal state is being cleaned up. The municipal council launched a campaign yesterday to remove trash from the streets of Wau, hoping this will not only improve the way the streets look, but also reduce the risk of catching certain diseases. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Wau.
Municipal council employees are walking along the streets of Wau, removing garbage piles, plastic bottles tossed by passers-by, and uprooting weeds that have sprung up along roadways. Wau Deputy Mayor Santino Manut says neighborhood leaders and municipal workers have been rallied to take part in the clean-up. Manut says they started picking up trash yesterday at the runabout by Hajar Market. Manut says the three-day clean-up campaign will beautify Wau and make it a healthier place to live. Manut says it is mandatory for town employees to be involved in the clean-up and says anyone who refuses will face the consequences. He says the clean-up will start every day at 8:30 in the morning and last until noon. After that, town employees will go back to their offices to work. Gabriel Osman works for the town of Wau. He says he hopes people who see town employees clearing the streets of litter and weeds will feel inspired to roll up their sleeves and pitch in themselves. Osman says the people of Wau love having a clean town, and he expects a big turnout for the clean-up. He says the volunteers and town workers will clean residential areas, markets, and even town council buildings and the airport. Residents say they are already ridding areas in Wau of piles of garbage, stagnant water and weeds. They say this is a good way to protect against diseases like cholera, which often breaks out when there is inadequate trash collection and lack of access to clean water and sanitation. Wau resident Amal Ismail says if residents want to prevent cholera, they need to work together to maintain a certain level of cleanliness in their homes and outside in the town. Earlier this week, town officials warned residents against throwing rubbish and construction breaks along the roadways. But a resident who did not want to be identified says that as long as the municipal authorities don't place dustbins along city streets and improve garbage collection, people will continue dumping all sorts of rubbish onto the roads and it will sit there, making Wau an attractive city and increasing the risk of catching an illness. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio reporting in Wau.
Community leaders in Western Bahr al-Ghazal state say residents are not taking full advantages of services provided by non-governmental organizations, largely because they are not aware of these services. During a two-day conference that opened today, the leaders say even though health services are available and schools are provided, people don't visit the clinics or send their children to school. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Wau.
At the start of a two-day conference that opened today at Wau Peace Hall, sponsored by NGOs such as HealthNet, Ju River County Commissioner Simon Athwai said, outdated cultural traditions still prevent locals from seeking health services.
Pregnant mothers are not visiting PHCU, PHCC to see the midwife. They are still going back to their traditional ones, which is not safe. Those who are sick with malaria,
they don't take malaria drugs. They go back for trees, herbs, which are not medically secure.
Athwai says local officials should develop guidelines that encourage residents to take advantage of the health services provided. 36-year-old Edward Ngong Tong, chairman of the Health Management Committee in Mbili, says complications during birth are one of the biggest challenges facing his community. But he says slowly that is starting to change.
Sometimes there are complicated childbirth that are encountered by the community. But as for now, Health Nurse has also rehabilitated a separate room for mothers to be put to rest and being taken care of by the trained community health workers and midwives trained by HealthNet. I believe this is a very significant achievement.
South Sudan has one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the world. Aidan Golden-Smith is the country coordinator for Dutch consortium of NGOs trying to improve South Sudan's health care system. Golden-Smith says despite the challenges of cultural norms that shown modern health care and education, he has seen some improvement in South Sudanese communities.
We've seen PTAs building parts of schools. This is free work that they do themselves. They're providing the materials, the labor. They're also going around to different villages to promote education and to encourage other parents to send their kids to school.
Ju River County has one of the lowest school enrollment rates for girls in all of Western Baragazali State. Primary causes include early marriage and teenage pregnancies. Simon Otuol is the program coordinator for the Kwarjena Community Development Program. He too believes local officials need to promote education for girls.
We conducted different education campaigns, particularly on girl-child education. And thereafter, we have observed that there is an increase in statistic of female students or female pupils in school, in primary school.
Within the last 4 years, Otuol says members of his community have been calling on authorities to provide clean drinking water and other basic services to residents. Not all of those services have been provided, but officials, like Otuol says, the more people get involved, the more they are likely to see a change for the better. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
In South Sudan, orphaned girls and boys are not likely to learn how to read or write. But that's changing thanks to an organization called Make Way Partners. It describes itself as the only indigenous-operated relief organization in the region helping orphans and former slaves. Make Way Partners president Kim Lee Smith tells VOA's Kim Louise they are educating more than 1,500 boys and girls.
We actually have three schools, two in South Sudan, one near the border of Darfur, and one down near the border of Uganda. They're about 1,000 miles apart. And then the third one is just across the north border in North Sudan of the Nuba Mountains. I'm excited to see what's happening in all of them, of course, in a country where education is so scant, and a 13-year-old girl has a higher likelihood of dying in childbirth than she does learning to read or write, become literate at all. And so I'm just so proud that we now have the first high school in the entire area where we are there near Darfur. We have 750 students, and a little more than half of them are girls who every day study English, Dinka, which is their mother tongue, Kiswahili, so that they can be effective throughout this portion of Africa, but also Arabic.
What age ranges are the students in?
No one really knows their exact ages, and so it's difficult to say. We tend to assess children by their physical development, so of course there is a lot of margin for error there. But in the high school, our average girl will be between the ages of 12 and 20.
Are the high schools, are they a four-year high school?
Yes, 4 years.
What happens to the girls when they leave? Where do they go?
We haven't had that yet. We started in this particular region, we started just over 10 years ago, and we started with the first grade. We just did open enrollment, letting any child that first come, first serve, we did open enrollment, took in 153 students. And when some of those were able the very next year to move on to the second grade, and so we started as a second grade. The next year, we opened the third grade, and so forth. And so this year, we now have 11th graders, what we would call 11th graders, in our high school. And next year will be our first graduating class. And so we are extremely excited about that opportunity. Our goal will be to scholarship. There will be about 25 young men and women who, for the first time in this entire region, will be graduating high school, receive a diploma from high school. So it is definitely a big deal. And we will scholarship these children to neighboring countries, Uganda or Kenya, not here in the U.S., but neighboring African countries, where they can stay as close to their culture as possible, and they will be signing contracts to come back into the country and help serve within their country. The point is for internal change, but those contracts are really a small thing in that this is the hunger and desire. They have been raised in this, and they see the difference between what life for them is and life for their siblings, for example, who didn't make it into the orphanage, or life just out in the community in general.
You brought up the high number of females in the high school,
yes,
which is really great to see. So how does this affect girls who sometimes don't get that opportunity to go to school?
One of the ways in which I see that it has affected them is the cultural pressure from outside is so huge that literally tells these girls that by the time you're menstruating, it is your duty to repopulate our country. But we'll have extended family members, uncles. We had one girl in particular who, when she was about 12 years old, uncle kidnapped her and tied her in his tukul, his little mud house, for 3 days, telling her it was her obligation to start having babies and could not be free and go back to school. We looked for her, could not find her. It took 3 days for her to get free and come back to us and tell us what had happened. Of course, we have been able to keep her. That young girl is now in our graduating class that will graduate next year. And so we see she was willing to stand up for the right to become literate, the right to do something special in her life. So she's planning on going on to medical school after graduation.
That was Kimberly Smith, president and co-founder of Make Way Partners. She was speaking with VOA's Kim Lewis from Rapid City, South Dakota, earlier today. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, an American-based service group works to boost the number of South Sudanese with access to electricity for long term. That story after this.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
are you at your best in the morning or later in the day?
Well, it's later on in the day. I start off the morning really slow, but then as time goes on, I get more energized and I concentrate more on what I'm doing.
In the morning, my brain is fresh and I can easily understand everything. I can easily think. Then in the evening, I'm also good because of the clubs. I'm sure of going to the club and have some happiness. Yeah.
In the morning, I wake up early. I can do a whole day job in the morning. In the afternoon, I want to relax and stuff like that.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Less than a quarter of the hundreds of millions of people who live in sub-Saharan Africa have access to electricity. In South Sudan, the percentage is even lower. In fact, it's only 5%, according to the World Bank. But a U.S.-based service organization is working to change that. S.I.N. Bure reports for VOA News from Washington.
The National Rural Electrification Co-op Association, or NRECA, has been working with USAID for the past 10 years to try to improve access to electricity in South Sudan. NRECA projects that are in the works in Kapweta, Yei, and Maridi are expected to provide power to about 1,200 customers when they are completed. That may be only 1/10,000 of the population of South Sudan, but it's a start. NRECA Executive Director Dan Waddle says the South Sudan electrification projects are designed to be long-term and self-sustaining. Not only will the NRECA projects give more South Sudanese access to electricity, but the U.S. organization is also teaching South Sudanese to build and maintain the power supply themselves.
Community members are directly involved in their power supply. And we would contend that there's no differentiation in the quality of service that can be provided. And that being the case, the service can be provided at a lower cost if the community members if their self-interest is to run the utility efficiently and operate it in a cost-effective manner.
Waddle says the NRECA is also training South Sudanese to do maintenance, administrative, and management jobs.
Doing projects like this, it's not such that you can build the infrastructure and walk away tomorrow. You have to establish the local institutional capacities such that they can maintain, operate, and manage the financial resources in perpetuity.
But Waddle says bringing electricity to Yei, Maridi, and Kapweta has not been cheap. He says the cost of power in these regions is very high. He says customers are charged about 60 to 65 cents per kilowatt hour, or at least five times as much as the 12 to 15 cents per kilowatt hour that the average American pays.
So it's extremely expensive for the local residents. And what I'd say is, trying to establish these utilities as self-sustaining institutions, it's been a struggle for them and, for us to find innovative solutions that will help them gain their financial and institutional footing has been very, very difficult.
Waddle says instability in South Sudan has made it even harder to bring electricity to the three towns. But now that a peace deal has been signed, that obstacle might be removed or at least become a little smaller. The NRECA is funded by the U.S. government under the Electrify Africa Act, which is an initiative to bring electricity to 50 million more Africans by 2020. For VOA News, I'm Ayan Bior in Washington.
The World Health Organization says the practice of traditional medicine in Africa must be regulated to protect the public against potentially harmful practices. The message comes as the UN body commemorates the 13th African Traditional Medicine Day. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The Mbankomo neighborhood in Yaoundé is home to one of Africa's biggest centers of traditional medicine. 15 healers share a space where they see 30 to 50 patients each day. Among the patients is Herman Hadir, who says he prefers to be treated by traditional means.
I'm very interested in traditional medicine because I've tested some of the medicines and my problem was solved. I use traditional medicine concerning venereal diseases.
Herman is among the estimated 80% of Africans who rely mainly on traditional medicine to treat illnesses and deal with various conditions. Many Africans have no other choice as hospitals are often far away, expensive, or poorly staffed. But in the wrong hands, traditional medicine can have disastrous consequences. Last Sunday in Yaoundé, a 20-year-old woman died at the home of a traditional healer while having an abortion. Dr. Nick Nguanyam, a gynecologist at the St. Louis Clinic in northwestern Cameroon, says the traditional sector is now dominated by unqualified practitioners.
We are talking about the proper diagnosis, scientific diagnosis of a problem, and then the management. If we had proof that these things really work, there would be no trouble. But again, when something works, that's not good enough. When something works, we also have to make sure that it works and yet it doesn't cause a problem.
Dr. Dewa, one of Cameroon's leading traditional medicine promoters, says his field faces serious challenges because Cameroon has not enacted laws for the sector.
We need a law which will regulate traditional medicine. You cannot find somebody 40 where there's no law. You cannot tell somebody that you don't have the right when there's no law guiding. That is why there is this disorder. In fact, we will still continue to be singing like this until when the lawmakers one day will come up with a law that will guide our profession.
Dr. Mashidiso Moiti, the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa, released a letter this week urging governments to strengthen regulatory bodies for traditional health practitioners. He also called upon researchers to work with traditional practitioners to produce scientific evidence on the safety, effectiveness, and quality of their products. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of our top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. President Kiir spoke to senior army officers about the peace deal he signed recently and outlined how the government will implement the ceasefire, which took effect last week. Mr. Kiir also selected four generals to attend a workshop in Addis Ababa dealing with transitional security arrangements and implementing the ceasefire. South Sudan Army spokesman Colonel Philip Aguirre says all of the country's top military officers attended that meeting today. He says military officials agreed to implement provisions on security arrangements from the peace deal, which also calls for a workshop to be held in Addis. At the workshop, military officers will meet with their counterparts from Riek Machar's SPLM-IN opposition, as well as IGAD mediators, and talk about how to draw down forces in South Sudan. The U.S. says both sides must adhere to South Sudan's permanent ceasefire and develop security arrangements at that workshop, which begins on Saturday. In a statement released today, the U.S. also condemned recent fighting in Jonglei and Upper Nile states and called on all parties to immediately stop all hostile engagement. U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner says in the statement that the declarations ordering all forces to cease military operations is seen as a welcome step toward implementing the deal, but he warns against more fighting and says sanctions could be imposed if the government or opposition forces violate that ceasefire. And finally, community leaders in western Bahar el Ghazal State's Jur River County say residents are not taking advantage of services provided by NGOs, largely because they're not aware of them. A two-day conference began today encouraging community leaders to tell residents about health services and schools run by NGOs free of charge to residents. Jur River County Commissioner Simon Atwe says outdated cultural traditions often prevent locals from seeking health services, and he says local officials should develop guidelines that encourage residents to take advantage of the health services provided. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, Carol. And that brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Mungu Si by J.M. Kennedy.
Walolo, badi walele, badi lama ikadusia, biobo adusia, izi mungu nipoya, katedwe warungo niti otolu mungu si, biobo adusia.
Waluniti, katro wazoniti, katro bakoniti, zimungu matia. Katro waluniti, katro wazoniti, katro bakoniti, zimungu matia. Kondwa konia.
We have been listening to J.M. Kennedy with the song Mungu Si. I'm John Tanza in Washington. We are glad you could be here. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Izi Mungu.